Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to the Eye on College Football podcast here on CBSSports.com. I'm your host, Chip Patterson, and we are bringing it back. We're going to kick off the 2013 preseason podcast series with really one of our favorite regular shows. It is the Doddcast. And so now it is my pleasure to introduce the namesake of the Doddcast as he and I kick off another year of going through this podcast journey together, my good friend Dennis Dodd. Dennis, do you have any preseason rituals before the season starts from your angle as the senior columnist for CBSSports.com?
Sleep. Try to get my sleep in before... There'll be many a Saturday where I don't, morphing into Sunday after covering games. So you try to get physically fit and get ready. And one of the rituals that I find now is getting back into the habit of requesting credentials. It's like, oh yeah, I forgot to put on underwear. You know, okay, you got to do that, you know, before you do anything else, and try to do it ahead. So I'm not complaining. You talked about rituals. There you go.
Yes, no, absolutely. I always try. I'm like you. I try to get as physically fit as possible for the next five months that I'm going to spend sitting down in various seats as I watch hours of college football. But one of the things, as our preseason preparation has sort of come to a point where we've got our All-American list out, we've got all of our All-Conference list out, and on CBSSports.com, if you visit there right now, what you will find is – a four-part series that Dennis has been spending all offseason on, and it's really looking at the biggest issue in college football. And it's not the last year of the BCS. It's not the college football playoff or the selection committee. This is an issue that is threatening football as a sport in American culture, and it is the issue of concussions. And a lot of people have written about this, and it's sort of has a lot of studies, and it creates a lot of buzz, but Dennis, as we were sort of talking in preparation for this podcast, the thing that's really scary for somebody who supports football is the fact that none of the research and the different headlines and the claims, they're not unified. They're not connected. It seems like it's all over the board right now.
Yeah, that was the main point of the series. As I started to get into it, I think there's a lot of well-intentioned people that want to attack this issue, but they're hindered by time. It just hasn't been researched long enough. We don't know the long-term effects of concussions. We don't know, for instance, if any of this causes the CTE, the chronic traumatic encephalopathy that killed Babe Duerson and allegedly led to the junior Seau's suicide. We don't know if that had anything to do with it. I point in one of the stories about even simple thing like helmets. There's a great biomechanical engineer at Virginia Tech who's been rating helmets for 4 years in terms of safety. Everybody loves it. Then I've got this chief medical officer from the Sports Concussion Institute who says, one helmet doesn't vary one to the other. So which is it?
Right.
Or is it even? You know, so we don't even know that. The chief medical officer of the NCAA said, you know, where we are right now with diagnosis of concussions is where we are with strokes 10 or 20 years ago. In fact, he went back and said women, for whatever reason, back in the day were given aspirin sometimes, you know, not knowing what else to do for a stroke. So he said the diagnosis of concussions right now is primitive. And I said, really primitive? And he said, I think that would be a good way to put it. And then you add into that the fact that the NCAA is in the crosshairs, at least legally, and a debate emerges about how much the NCAA should even be responsible for any of this. You know, they say, no, we aren't responsible for the duty of care, which puts them in a liability standpoint. And the point of this Adrian Arrington lawsuit is to say, absolutely, you're responsible for all the athletes you oversee medically. And what about the aftercare? So it's a giant catch-22, and I don't know when it's going to be solved in the near future.
The NCAA's chief medical officer that you just mentioned, Brian Hainline, right?
Hainline, yeah.
Hainline. And you said that his his even presence, you know, the fact that the NCAA reached out and got him because of his experience should show that the NCAA at least recognizes, at least someone in a decision-making position realizes that this is a very, very, very serious issue.
Yeah, no, he's been great. And professionally, his hiring has been widely praised. I like him because he's very frank and talks about the issue. I suspect, I don't know, that the NCAA saw this issue rising and said, we need to do something, at least cosmetically, to address this first off. And they hired Hainline, who is a neurologist with 25 years experience, who I thought was very telling when I said, how much of this issue, you know, what percentage takes up your time? And he said, half. You know, one affliction, concussion, takes up half the NCAA chief medical officer's time right now. That ought to tell you how important that issue is right now.
There is a claim that one of the reasons why concussions are so difficult to sort of break down and understand from a medical perspective, particularly in the game of football, is the fact that no two concussions are the same and no two individuals will react the same to the same amount of impact. So certain rules, you know, getting somebody to leave the field after their helmet pops off is a measure, but you could almost argue that seems to be a way to battle public sentiment rather than ever really take a hard look at how to diagnose these concussions better on the sideline.
Well, I actually think that rule had a lot of foresight, and by the way, it worked. I know a lot of people were upset that players had to leave for a play last year if their helmet popped off, but statistically, it showed that in the second half of the season, those helmets were staying on. So the desired effect took hold, and I think from the rules committee standpoint, they're just trying to change the culture. I mean, you're probably going to raise the issue of the new ejection rule to go along with targeting. I'm coming around to the point that I think it's a good adjustment to the rule, because back in the day, fighting used to be common in football. I'm not talking about the 1800s. 18 players died alone in 1905 before Teddy Roosevelt got involved. And those were very bad things. And these are very bad things, you know, potentially. You know, you don't want Eric LeGrand to happen again. So
right.
If it changes the behavior and changes the culture, I'm all for it. I don't think what the reactionaries say, oh, it's going to be touch football. No, it's not going to be touch football. But how football is played today doesn't resemble the way it was played in the 60s or maybe even the 70s or 80s. Because you have guys lead. I think we all agree that guys are trying to do damage a lot of times instead of playing football. They're not trying to intimidate. They're trying to maim. And that has to be taken out of the game.
One of the suggestions that I saw in the across the series, there's really a wealth of work that has been done by Dennis during this offseason, and I've got it in my notes. I don't remember where it was included, which interview, but the idea that, you know, there's an NCAA mandated 20-hour limit to the amount that these players can sort of work and practice, you know, what if you add to that and you make it constructive and you make it part of it, teaching the correct way to tackles, teaching about head trauma, you know, helping these players that are 18 to 22 years old realize that the decisions that they're making on the field with the way that they play are having very, very serious long-term effects. I really liked that idea because, you know, we already see college football players, they're, you know, the quote unquote voluntary workouts are not voluntary. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're asking everything when it comes to their time. We might as well spend some of that time really working on changing the game and the way it's played if it's going to help in the long run.
Yeah, and what you're referring to is the second story in the series where I talked to Joel Klatt,
the old
Colorado quarterback who's had 10 concussions while he played. Last played in 2005. Now knows he has 10 concussions. And that was his take. And I think it's good. I think it's a small step. I think these players sometimes come to college football largely less than formed, complete football players, and coaches complain about that. You know, if you're going to adjust the rule, then you ought to give us time to teach these guys how to play, because a lot of times they don't know how to play even when they get to college correctly.
Right.
They know how to play football. They just don't know how to play it correctly. So, and some of them say, should we waste our time having to teach these kids how to play or tackle correctly? They should come to us like that. You see the Pac-12 and the Ivy League are limiting full contact practices now to 2 a week. I think that's largely non-controversial because everybody pretty much does that at the most. But there's two coaches, and I'll name them, Urban Meyer and Bill O'Brien. I talked with them about this at the Big Ten Media Days. Conceptually, they're okay with it, but they don't want anybody telling them how often they can hit. During game week, I mean, and that goes back to, you know, what you don't want is these kind of punitive practices where we got beat 50-0 and we're going to hit every day this week. You know, that's the reason the NFL, which is a players association, bargained in, you know, one day a week in their contract. Well, there is no players association for college in the NCAA, and that's why these conferences are stepping in. And I think it's a good thing because the NCAA in that particular subject matter isn't. They don't feel it's their it's their thing to do.
In so many cases where there are ongoing legal issues, we've seen throughout college football and throughout college sports in general, you try and leave yourself open to as little liability as possible. Is that sort of the NCAA's game plan through all this? Because I know you've done some research with the Adrian Arrington case, Eastern Illinois defensive back who now suffers seizures as a result of his concussions. And if the NCAA doesn't want it on their hands and the conferences are making more efforts to try and combat this, doesn't that make matters even worse for the NCAA, which is struggling to govern college football as it is?
Yeah, that has been their habit, their MO over the years, the path of least resistance, while taking somewhat of a big brother approach, but not with a heavy hand in these situations, because, again, they don't want to be seen as having hard and fast rules. I had a defense attorney tell me if I was recommending to the NCAA, I would recommend they don't put stricter measures in for concussions because then you do become liable. You know, someone can get hurt and say, hey, I did everything that was in the medical handbook and I'm still paralyzed. Well, who's liable for that? Your rules weren't strong enough. So that's what you see with a giant catch-22 for 35 years between the time of the first documented death in sickle cell trait, I think it was 1976 in Colorado, to 2011 when the NCAA was forced because of a settlement and a lawsuit to put stronger language in. The NCAA didn't even recommend testing for sickle cell trait. Part of the reason, historically, was it didn't want to be seen as racial profiling. Well, I don't think there's much racial profiling when I think the number is 88% of the cases. It predominantly affects African Americans. We know that. I don't think you're profiling racially if you recommend testing for it. And so now they do it, but you have to sign a waiver and, that you don't know that you have it already. So if you read this medical handbook, it's like reading a first-year law student textbook. It has not very much to do with medicine, but just enough to do to cover their butt sometimes.
Well, that's disappointing. Of all the different interviews that you, and this has been work that goes back to January, who'd you profile that seemed to be the most revealing or intriguing of the group?
Oh boy, I didn't profile this person, but I think this is the most. This kind of sums up, an issue that we face. And it's not new. I mean, it's been written about. Dr. Robert Cantu out of Boston University, he heads one of the head trauma research centers there, is one of the leading authorities, maybe the leading authority on this subject. Has worked with the NFL, has worked with the NCAA. The problem is Dr. Robert Cantu, at the same time he's fighting and helping research of concussions, took $38,000 from Adrian Arrington's lawyer to write an expert witness opinion in the class action filing. Is that not a conflict of interest? And I think it was Outside the Lines pointed out, you know, he's been working, consulting with the NFL, but has also met openly with lawyers who want to sue the NFL. So, you know, what are we talking about here? What, you know, have pick a lane. You know, money can't be that important to you in this particular matter. You have to have to play both sides of the track, especially with what's at stake here.
Yeah. Do you think that sideline testing will continue to improve? Because I know Nebraska has that sort of mesh hat that they're trying out, and there's a lot of technology. Like you said, Virginia Tech's been sort of rating helmets over time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you? What are the next steps that you think will be the most productive as far as how college football can change in response to the issue of concussions?
Well, there is no sideline testing per se. There's, you know, it's really up to the schools to evaluate these players if they get their bell rung. But it, as I said in the piece, in the case of Joe Klatt, the Colorado quarterback, he used to hide from trainers if he knew he got dinged in the head. He wanted to play.
Yeah.
That's part of the problem with this. You know, there are trainers, there are doctors on the sideline. Virginia Tech has taken the bold step of, I think one of their team physicians wears a beeper, and their helmets are hooked up with sensors. So anytime they get a force of 98 Gs or higher, the beeper goes off, and they're immediately targeted for examination on the sidelines. Doesn't mean they're coming out, but they are going to be examined, you know, to see if they're ready to go back to play. And I think that's rudimentary. I think that's very smart. The thing you mentioned at Nebraska, that's in development. They're not using that yet. It's a web full of sensors which could detect, once it's put on the head, what they call biomarkers. And in layman's terms, that just means it would give you a number or a point beyond which this player shouldn't go back in the game. And again, like I said, that's still in development. I think it's going to happen. It's going to be a good thing. I should also say, I think that coaches, by and large, should be taken out of this, not out of the discussion, but certainly out of the treatment plan, because they've got a bias towards everyone on their team. They want them, theoretically, on the field. That's why you don't see much consultation with coaches on it. Yes, the AFCA is for this. But I don't think you want to leave it in the plans, the hands of coaches, to develop treatment and management systems for this stuff.
Well, the AFCA, American Football Coaches Association, mm-hmm. their big claim is that they're trying to get this at the beginning levels. You know, the AFCA right. is investing a lot of, you know, either manpower or money. I'm not exactly sure myself, but I know their big claim is we're going in to the way football is taught at the lowest levels, and we are trying to teach it the right way, because football taught the right way, not, you know, leading with your helmet and killing people. It entirely lessens the chances that a player could end up getting a concussion from head-to-head collision. Now, football is a violent sport, and it's impossible to get rid of the collisions altogether. But if the focus is on the right way to tackle, the right way to run, you know, that seems to be, in my mind, really one of the only places where the AFCA should be getting involved.
Yeah, they're in an advocacy role. I think that's right. You know, but you reminded me of something else. Robert Cantu, and there's some others, don't believe tackle football should be played until you're 14 years of age. Well, that, I don't think the people at Pop Warner think much of that.
Right.
You know, they are directly against that. That's what they do. They say football teaches character and toughness and everything else. So how do we get around? You know, there is no Pop Warner if that's the case. Just one of those conundrums I pointed out. I don't know how you get around those. I had one doctor tell me the brain isn't fully formed until humans sometimes are 24 years old. And so we're going to, and you add to that the overarching fact that no one disputes, there's not a helmet on earth that can 100% protect you from a concussion.
Yeah. All right, so when Teddy Roosevelt saved the game from being outlawed altogether and the game opens up, sort of, passes could finally go more than 5 yards beyond the line of scrimmage, right? There were a few changes that I think it was number of players in the backfield, different rule changes that kind of opened up the game and sort of got us moving away from rugby and more
right.
towards the game today. Do you think that college football will change? And, like, for example, I think when I hear that tackle football shouldn't be until the age of 14, then you think of flag football, you think of, you know, who's mm-hmm. going to be the players that develop. It's the ones that are playing, you know, offense and defense in the 7-on-7. Do you mm-hmm. think, A, that we are, you know, headed in that direction, as some people claim, and do you think that's necessarily a bad thing?
Funny you should mention that. That's my piece for Thursday. the future of football in all this. Yes, I think it'll look a lot different. I don't think it'll be touch football. I think you're already headed there with some of these finesse offenses. You know, the zone read spread option is a finesse offense. I think players will be smaller and faster. It's hard to put Jadeveon Clowney in there as a smaller player, but at 6'6", 274, he plays off the edge and is very, very fast. I mean, he can bull rush you as much as go past you. Wes Welker is a good example. He's dominated at whatever he is, 5'9", 185. And I think we'll see more of that. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I forgot to point out in the previous question, you know, the NFL is going to put neurosurgeons or one of those categories on the sidelines this year. I think that's a no-brainer.
Right.
You know, to treat possible catastrophic injuries and to evaluate injuries and headshots. You know, I think that's one thing. I think in 20 years you won't see the kickoffs anymore. Maybe pretty soon, considering that Roger Goodell has advocated that now. I don't think we need it. They took it away. They adjusted the rules, we know, in the NCAA last year to keep the balls being returned. 2 years ago, it was one of every 2.5 kickoffs were returned. Last year, it was one of every 6. And concussions on that play alone went down 50%. Well, now wipe them out almost, you know, wipe them out 100%. It's the old Greg Schiano thing. It's after scores.
4th and 15, right?
Fourth and 15, you can either punt or go for it. And you move on from there. I think it'd be highly entertaining. I don't think we're wedded to – there will be traditionalists who bemoan the lack of the kickoff. But I think it's too easy, if we're really going to address this, to do just that.
Yeah. Well, he is Dennis Dodd. He's the senior college football columnist at CBSSports.com. He is the namesake, the inspiration, and the God walking on earth that inspires the Doddcast. And I do appreciate the time, Dennis.
I do, too. Upward and onward, ready to kick it off.
Absolutely. Remember, you can get all the CBSSports.com college football podcasts by subscribing on iTunes. We'll deliver them right away. Be sure to go ahead and do that. We're going to start rolling out conference previews all over the next week and a half. For Dennis Dodd, I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.